it's about time to move into the via negativa. I think that a lot of people still, even though this is closer to the traditional views, that a lot of people still have more trouble with this than they do with the via positiva. Because this is the theology of the cross. And somehow we still seem to have been promised a perfect way of whatever it is. And one of my favorite writers is Lewis Thomas, Lives of a Cell and Medusa and the Snail and about four or five other books, who is, it's notes of a biology watcher. He doesn't claim in any of his writings that I've seen to be Christian, but you can't get any more creation-centered, it seems to me, than a biology watcher who happens to be marvelously gifted in writing the literary form called an essay. You know that form as the essay. He writes marvelous essays, has been writing them for years for journals, and these are just gatherings of them. So they're fun just to read. And of course, his to get us in the mood for what I think we're going to be talking about, he talks about the greatest single achievement of nature to date has been the invention of the molecule DNA. And he talks about, of course, that it wasn't invented, it was there the whole time, it had been all around. He worries about the use of the word progress in talking about our understanding of all that. But then he goes on to say, well, he says, if we hadn't had that, we wouldn't have what we have around today. The city of Paris, the state of Iowa, Cambridge University, and he just lists all the kinds of things we wouldn't have. But then this paragraph, we could never have done it with human intelligence. Even if molecular biologists had been flown in by satellite at the beginning, laboratories and all, from some other solar system. We have evolved scientists, to be sure, and so we know a lot about DNA. But if our kind of mind had been confronted with the problem of designing similar replicating molecules, starting from scratch, we'd never have succeeded. We would have made one fatal mistake. Our molecule would have been perfect. Given enough time, we would have figured out how to do this, nucleotides, enzymes, and all, to make flawless, exact copies. But it would have never occurred to us, thinking as we do, that the thing had to be able to make errors. The clue of the DNA is that it can make mistakes. It can go wrong. There's another chapter that follows. It's equally interesting. I won't read. To err is human. And he said, no, that's terribly important to be able to.
Is that just the observations that he's made?
Right, yeah, these are, he'll react to something that he's seen. Yeah. Like this little essay deals with the fact that the DNA had to be able to make errors in order for it to be able to do it. And our concept of things, of life, is, it seems to me, as he was saying, quite distinct from that. If we can get rid of errors, if we can get rid of illness, for instance, or deterioration, you know, and then the microbiologist says, you know, it's the things that we call illness and deterioration are essential to the process of life. And we just don't put that together. I think that is what our friend Fox is saying here. In order to understand, much less to live, the via positiva, with all of the glory of God, to understand how what we call mistakes, what we call pain, what we call evil, is part of existence. And we've still come out, perhaps because of our training, you know, that God is trying to do away with all evil, and the good is always on the side of God, that anything that we don't like, anything that we don't enjoy, or anything that we fear is automatically our enemy. I think that what he is trying to get us to do, to maybe look at it in a different way. That is not to say enjoy pain, you know, or, you know, sadomasochism. I always get it wrong.
Masochism.
Any of that. But it's another way of perceiving what is going on in the universe or within our spiritual journeys that is more in tie with the universe. And that's why I consider his writings not only enjoyable, but I think important. Just had a new one come out, too. I don't have that yet.
Does that tie in? I don't know if you said it, or if Fox said it, or some of these other things we've been reading. Our strength is in our
fearless. Oh, my. I think St. Paul said our faith. one of those people was either Fox. My strength is made perfect in weakness, is Paul's.
Well, yes, but that was the sentence. Oh. Our power or our strength is in our fearless.
The great paradox of ministry is that we minister above all of our weakness.
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't read that description.
But it's, so there are a good number of people saying that, you're saying, which is important.
The enemy has to be able to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. That's their. Mm-hmm. That's its power. Mm-hmm. It seems to me.
And how it fights so much of what we struggle with about not being accepted or not being worthwhile or not being perfect. I've said this a number of times, and maybe already with you people, the one passage that is translated, well, it's in here too. You shall be perfect, for I, the Lord your God, am perfect. It has filled more psychiatrists and psychologists' offices than probably any other Bible passage.
It seems we strive for the wrong things.
Right. And if he's right, and the better word is compassionate, you shall be compassionate, for I, the Lord your God, am compassionate. That word is translatable in that way, which would make it lots different than the perfection that we're talking about. That's on the right-hand side somewhere in here. I don't remember which page at the moment. Well, that's sort of as introduction to getting into the themes for the day. And I once again, I guess I would like to invite you to just to spend 15 minutes in small groups talking about the three themes, the 11, 12, and 13. So let's see, four, and maybe three, if you want to sit with them. These three here, these four there, and these four here. So this would be group 11, group 12, and then group 13 over here. And if you know, just to quickly look at them, it's emptying, letting go of images, and letting silence be silence is 11. I'm particularly interested in that one, in asking you to. Well, it's dealing with the whole business of pain and suffering, especially on page 136, what that means. And then his understanding of silence. Those are just two things. And if you find whatever you want in the chapter, bring it back. I mean, in that section, bring it back. But those are two things that interested me. And in 12, which is the being emptied, which is a very difficult thing, it seems to me, for us to get in touch with. It revolves around the same thing of the suffering, and I liked especially his connection that he feels all creatures suffer, not just humans. And see what response you have to the rest of the creation, the suffering of the rest of creation. Is there such a thing in your view? And then the third, the nothingness of theme number 13. In there, I think that it's intriguing. This is on page 153, that he connects humor and laughter to the experience of nothingness. And I'd like your reactions to that, if you would. I happen to be strongly committed to the role of humor and the comic, you know, in its broad sense, not jokes, but humor, the comic, to the life of creation. The spiritual journey, creation-centered, well, any center, but I'd say also creation-centered. And I'd be curious what your response is to that. So, 11 and 12 and then 13, if you would spend some time with that.
Well,
about 15 minutes, and then we'll come back and share and ask for Janice to respond to our sharing. Okay?
Two words that I couldn't find in the dictionary.
All right, which, what page?
Page 130.
Catabatic God.
And you're at the bottom of the page.
Oh, here. Okay.
I don't know my Greek roots.
The phatic, yeah.
He's making up words.
Yeah, he, that's what he's doing. Well, the kata is you know, pull in. The apogee would be up away. That.
The God apple, is away from us.
Away and God's present.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
The push and pull. You can, if you want to move to another part of the room, you certainly may, if you have a little more privacy. Dive into Via Negativa, Path 2, and letting go. That's this lovely group right over here, right?
Right.
Who are going to inform us, stimulate us, educate us. What have you to say about your response to theme 11?
I hung up on the word befriend.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Want to say more about that?
Well, maybe first just an observation of David's that didn't connect with anything else, but might be relevant. He says that we have to remember that too much sun is painful. You can't bear to really look in at the sun.
Too intense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But our problem with befriend is on page 136, where it says in the middle paragraph there, after the reference to Jonathan Schell, talking about nuclear annihilation, and he says, if we do not face frontally this unimaginable darkness, meaning nuclear extinction, and befriend it, enemy that it is, we shall surely pay the price all those pay who repress the shadow. And my question was, how do we as Christians find the dividing point between what we befriend and accept and what we rebel against and say, this isn't God's will and we must fight against this, this is injustice, this. What does this befriend mean?
Mm-hmm. Anybody have some feelings about that? Responses?
I've been trying to say that if we don't recognize it, then we can't be anything
about
it.
Okay.
Well, I'm thinking, what is befriend? Is to be in relationship with, to recognize the relationship. This friendship, this relationship, and what is friendship? But the seeing the good and accepting it, and seeing what's wrong in your friend. I mean, if you cannot accept your friend's faults and failures and limitations and inabilities, you're not a friend.
And but so, can you do that with nuclear extinction? Can you see good?
Well, I don't think that word. Face the unimaginable darkness of nuclear extinction.
Well, isn't it asking us to love our enemies?
But that isn't an enemy. That isn't a human.
The whole of creation spirituality would be to understand that, you know, it isn't only humans that are involved, you know, in anything. Or the same that we were talking about yesterday, or day before yesterday, in befriending death. Remember, we talked, I don't know if we talked about it, but that was in that one section about what does it mean to befriend death. I'm not saying that makes it easier, but is it the same as our Lord saying, if you have an enemy, let's say it's a really virulent an enemy, one that is seeking to kill you, and you're asked to love.
That doesn't mean you should lie down and die right now.
I think not. Because he calls it, yet here, enemy that it is. This in unimaginable darkness, enemy that it is. And I guess, what do I understand your question, though, what does it mean to befriend or love or whatever it is, this enemy, mm-hmm. which is death, which is annihilation, which is just, as far as we can perceive, then the destroying of everything that we know. I think it's right on question. What could that possibly mean?
But it's part of ourselves.
Indeed.
We cannot separate the existence of nuclear extinction in today's world from ourselves. It's a part of who we are and what we are doing. It's choices that we are making. And so, too, that's... you cannot make peace with yourself until you see, until you stop denying what it is that you have done or who you are, and be honest about everything that you are.
And you're saying that part of what we are is also nuclear destruction, and therefore we must make peace with that, or in Fox's words, befriend.
To reject it, mm-hmm. and say, this is not part of me, is to split yourself and divide yourself and hate yourself.
Well, there is a part of myself that I have to hate.
No, I think she's saying, if we reject it, then we are hating.
But I mean, there are impulses that I fight against.
No, I think that is the whole point of the via negativa, is that you don't hate that in yourself. That.
But I don't see how you can get from path 2 to path 4, where you see things as injustice. That what was said last night about Central America was evil. And I don't see how you can just befriend it and say, this is good, this is...
I guess
what
Ben says.
No, I didn't say it was good, but I'm saying own it. It's part of you. Mm-hmm. It's part of you. And the thing is, we have to own this impulse for total destruction, because it is a part of us. And we have to accept that's truth about us. Because any other way, I mean, just think what happens if we don't. Think what happens if we don't. If we say that the impulse for nuclear extinction is not me, it's you. See? It's the Russians that want to do it.
Sure,
if you can take that energy of evil and put it on anybody else, then you're not responsible for it. They're responsible for it.
But that becomes too big a burden to bear to think that I'm responsible for the person that wants to assault or rape or kill. The every evil is me too. How do I bear that? When a man wants to break into my house, when he wants to knock me down and steal, yeah. How do I say, great.
John,
I remember reading it. Yeah.
Book is on that very subject.
Yeah.
But that seems to me that he's not...
No, not Politics of Jesus, his other book, when somebody comes to kill your spouse or your loved one, and what do you do? You know, we say, in that case, I'll defend. And John says, no. Do that. So it's a book that he read.
But I don't see that's necessarily...
What I'm saying. I was talking about being responsible.
That's right. Sure.
Yeah.
And I think...
this is another...
Here's what
dimension.
I'm trying to say, and I don't feel really real coherent about it, but what I'm saying is that what is it that we have got wrong about nuclear extinction? We have got wrong that we're human and not God. You know, Dorothy Soye said that all those nuclear bombs are not aimed at each other. but aimed at God. The arrogance that we have, the thing that we have done that's wrong, is that we have taken, in the most arrogant way, the authority to create. We have taken this incredible creativity, Matthew Fox says, that we have been given as a gift from God, and we have misused that creativity to create a horrible weapon for destruction. And the thing that's wrong is that we are not God. We do not have the right to, we are not God, we are human. And that's, you know, that's.
But to me, that's what original sin is. This rebellion against God. That we come back to that then, that I have in me this rebelliousness and that the redemption of Christ is to survive that rebellion and to accept me despite that. If I don't have that, but then it's all up to me to accept the negative and somehow transform that.
No, not at all. That certainly is not what Fox is saying in this chapter at all. Not at all. He's saying exactly what you just said, it seems to me. So the answer to your question is, yes, you better own it. To think that Central America is worse than the thoughts that you and I have this morning is gross distortion. Then again, it's Central America that's bad, or the nuclear, or the rapist, or the gunman, and not us. To put those in different categories of separation from God, that they need as much as we do, what you're talking about. He's getting into the theology of the cross, the fact that it took only the cross to make it possible to survive what you're saying. My answer to your first question, which I purposely didn't answer you, how can I bear that, is you can't. But it is already born in Jesus Christ. That's where our connection is.
But he never says that, as you're saying.
Not it as well. Because it says, that's not a compliment. That's not a compliment when you're looking at a badly written book and saying, I can say it better than that. All you're saying is you're really saying it better than a badly written book. That's all. No, he isn't as explicit about that. But he does, if you plow in there, it's there that he counts on that. And you know, the cross is the cross of Jesus Christ in this chapter. Again, as badly as he doesn't say it well. But when you get into the chapter, when you get into the fourth theme in here, he gets as close to it as he's going to get. But he does it in the Christian context, and when he is at his best, as I've said, he doesn't say fall redemption theology, creation, spirituality is wrong. He just said it has been distorted. It has been only that.
And trying to correct it.
And so in his effort to correct, he does go, I think, you know.
Can you see this, and this was, one of you said it, in Jesus on the cross, can you see him?
We were talking about letting go of images. And I said, did Christ let go of God? Here on page 137. We have to, no symbols or images were allowed to hang around. Not even our names and symbols for God can go unchecked. We pray even to let go of God. Here, if anywhere, lies sheer abandon. When Christ was crying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you turned away from me? So he still had that image.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know, did Jesus master
that? Must have been the deepest despair that has been experienced.
That's what most of the time we say, I think, when we come to the abandonment by God. I'm not sure it's the same as what you're saying either. I mean, that's fuzzy for me.
Yeah.
But yes, I think to what you're saying.
My understanding, perhaps,
go.
See, it's my understanding because I haven't read it. Even in the steam, but perhaps what he's trying to get at is when we try to conceptualize and think about things, we can only think about things as we've learned them, as people have taught us, and so on and so forth. So if we try to go through an exercise in which we sort of get rid of all our the baggage that we bring with us. And, you know, if we can appreciate, can understand something, it's because of our metaphors that we use to, he's saying let go of God, you know, perhaps it's just letting go of our images of God and what we have made God to be. Because what we have made him to be, he probably isn't at all, or he's much more than that. Mm-hmm. So if we let go of all these images completely, just empty ourselves, and then try to maybe reflect on things, and it might give it more meaning.
The whole thing, the example he used about you learn the dark, or let's fear the dark, by thinking of our what goes on inside of our bodies, mm-hmm. and all the inner workings, and even when we are conceived, probably on mm-hmm. a dark darkness, and we Psalm 139 mm-hmm. speaks to that. That you know my inward parts, you knit me together in my mother's womb. And it goes on. It's mm-hmm. beautiful. So that's, what was I going to say? Oh, it's the darkness we can know if we think about that, the inside of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And now to the pain and suffering, talked about when pain of a death of a loved one or something like that, it just shatters you. You have no words. You're completely at a loss. And like June said, it's not a choice whether we choose to let go of images. We're just stunned. So that's a real good example of that.
It seems to me what David was saying, too, that I think ties to this is that if our image or our metaphor or whatever it is cannot conceive, and I think I remember the gasp last time when I said this in the group, God being connected with the Holocaust. Is it because of our metaphors that we won't allow that, that we have a clean-cut God that must fit our images of what it's about? Now, that sounds like I'm trying to blame it on God or whatever else. I'm not. But is there some way in which all of that happens that our images get in the way of that? Or if, let's say, the mistakes of biology or the body or the systems, whatever else, that where we don't want mistakes connected, and unless a small matter, a Holocaust is a gross matter. Is there some way that we have to let go in order for new things to happen? Now that's on that level, but there are other levels that I think are more obvious. The most obvious one to me is the male image and dimension of the hierarchical thing that we put into it that distorts our view of what it means to be related to God. I see a series of things that are there, and some we are more willing to accept than others. I'm not trying to say they're all right, I mean, but those are the struggles that I have.
Maybe that fear of death is at the bottom of it, that we say those 6 billion people shouldn't have died, mm-hmm. and that God deserted them. But my God is with me all the time. Mm-hmm. If God was there in the midst of it to give them courage and hope, and the ones who escaped were surely blessed with God.
Sure.
And that poster in the bookstore, Martin Luther King talking about his death before his death, knowing he had a vision that he mm-hmm. would be killed, mm-hmm. and that he said his death was redemptive.
Well, just think of all the strides that have been made since he was assassinated, which maybe wouldn't have happened for another 50 years if he hadn't been. Same way with other things that have come along in our lives. social problems.
If we're talking about creation-centered spirituality and talking, maybe getting a little bit away from the Holocaust, because that's a hard one, which we don't, but just looking at other forms of death and silence. The silence of the life of our loved ones, that is inevitable. And our own ending, which is also inevitable. And in Indian tradition, those things are all wonderful. They are all perfectly right. Very important.
Even the Trail of Tears?
As we look at it, as we look at what has happened. You know, people say, like there's that book, God is Red. Mm-hmm. The real spiritual heart of America is in the Indian people's experience. This has been said about America, that our spiritual anchor in this country are the Indians. Because the messages that they are able to give to us as a country, as a nation, are part of God's gift of redemption for what we have done, for what we have done to the land. Because, and I'll just talk a little bit sort of lightly about that, and then maybe we can understand what I'm saying. How many of you have ever been out to a reservation? You know, sort of. What is the first thing that comes to your mind?
Souvenir shops.
Okay.
What?
What did it look like? Visually.
Visually.
What image comes to your mind?
All the debris blown about in the reservation.
The mess. The mess. And I have done a lot of thinking about this, because, like, in Nome, you know, people talk about Indians as being, you know, a lot of things. But one of the biggest things that people talk about all the time is the dirtiness and the mess. And I really have done some meditating on this, because as you go out to most reservations and you're like, I mean, here is that washing machine and that car and that trash. And, God, what a mess. Mm-hmm. And I try to understand why. Why, when I go on the reservation and I see all this stuff, what is so wrong about that? What is that? And I think I have a vision of what that is. That is the voiceless people making a statement about the values that you attach to these material things. That the things that you treasure, that you have made a god, It hurts so much to see that incredible machine, that washing machine out there just thrown away, dirty, falling over, and not taken care of. That car that is such a god, just, you know, dented in and not fixed and not appreciated and worshipped and loved. And I think Indian people are giving you a message. You know, I think they're telling you something that you could really enjoy to hear, because it's very free. I am very moved by the images of what they do when they throw these things out, and why is it so horrible? Why does it offend me? It's because those things are sacred to me. And that's why I don't want to see them thrown on the ground.
And perhaps they do that because it's not a conscious act, but rather one of their spirit that, you know, they don't subconsciously leave this trash out there so that those that have them as gods can see it. But it's because, since it isn't part of their being, their spirit, that it's, you know, the message is there. It's not a conscious act, I don't think. I mean, I wouldn't think of this, but, you know, if you don't have something as a as an idol don't have that same image of taking care of something and fixing it, then just let it be. Anyway, just be there.
That's, you know, how does that connect with this this via negativa, that the silence? They're not saying in words what the Trail of Tears means, you know? What, they're not, there is a silence coming out of Indian country, a silent message about the rest of the world. Last week I made a journey to the Warm Springs Reservation. This country, in taking the lands that the native peoples had, looked around and you could just tell when you go to Warm Springs, you go through this beautiful Columbia River gorge and the river, and that's not Indian country. It was Indian country, but that, you know, they didn't get that. And you go through the high plateau where the river is, and it's flat and it's fertile, and you see the trees, and the Indians didn't get that. You, as soon as the land becomes seemingly useless to the agrarian economy, that's the border of the Indian reservation. But it's really fascinating because that land that was given to the Indians is in a pristine state. It is retained the original look that all this other land had that has lost. And that is a silent message to this world. What it was like and what you have done to it. You know, well, look at what you have done to it.
You know the Columbia Gorge, evidently. The thing that hurt me the most was the making of those dams, the Bridge of the Gods there, the Cascade Locks. I remember them fishing there. They're little ones. They had a line on them, but the little ones were fishing there, and now it's all covered with water. It's no more. Same way with the dams.
Yeah.
And it's not Indian anymore. Sure, they give them a little space on this side of the road and also across the river there to come maybe once a year. But they don't fish in the same way.
How can those two things go together? What you just talked about, this silent message to us and our gods and the washing machines and so on, but how, in this love of the pristine land as it is, how can the Indian spirit bear to have that despoil, because that's despoiled, the land is despoiled too,
like such a contradiction.
By the what we tend to call junk and mess and so on. It seems like that would hurt their spirit.
Well, yeah, it does. But, you know, I'm not saying that this is a great thing. This is a great thing. I just think that it comes out of other cultures too, the yin and the yang, that, you know, what has happened, as I look at it though, is that this land that has been set aside being forced to move onto this land and being put in these usually totally inhospitable places are very difficult to survive, was a terrible thing. And yet, it may be that thing that is going to be there for you to know now that you've taken this land to the place.
Maybe salvation in that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's where it may be redemptive. It may be that the Trail of Tears, the suffering that the indigenous people, not only in this country, but I was thinking last night about the Mesquite and the Indians in the Amazon and the indigenous peoples in Nepal, and you know, that whatever it is that keeps these people alive ultimately is what will keep you alive.
I thought about that a lot too. I had more experience in New Guinea. And to me, it's a very pragmatic thing that in traditional living, one returned to the earth, the husk of the coconut and the bones of the fish and and it became part of the earth again. And now we have produced a culture where you can't throw things away and they don't dissolve and they don't decompose and they don't break up. And these people don't realize that, and they don't even realize what they're doing to themselves and polluting their environment. The rivers filled with tin cans, and they're around their homes with...
There isn't any difference, really, between taking it and putting a layer of soil over it and allowing that to leach into the aquifer. You know, it's visible.
And that's what offends us, that we see it.
But the principle, the thing that that I think is so beautiful and right about this Matthew Fox is that it says to us, let's stop denying this truth. You know, if you think that the messes that Indian people throw out of their doors and let hang around their houses are ugly, then you should see what you have done with your cities.
Our junkyards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know, just because you build a fence and don't look at it, if you fly over from the air,
it's there.
Or, you know, anything, it's all there. And so I think that that's what's wonderful about this, is that it, I think this is, I said to my group, this is the best part of the book. Mm-hmm. Because that is the thing that has to happen first, is we have to end our denial of the way things really are. And that silence is one of those ways of seeing everything the way it really is.
Some of that, I think, is tied up on page 166 in the Cross of Christ, where he says that's the ultimate letting go of that stuff. And what you've let go of is, what you said, is what's there. Can't be just the things we prefer to let go of, 166. Or as he said on the next page, to free all those held in slavery by the fear of death is to free all. It's that the salvation of Jesus brings primarily liberation from the fear of death. And often our unwillingness to admit what we are participating in is that fear yet of death, I believe.
You mean we're 15 minutes late?
No, it's time to close. Yeah, it's time to close. A couple minutes, any other reactions? You know, you don't have to, it's clear holding feeling that you don't have to agree everything that's said. You're free to think differently, speak differently. We hope that you would want to if you do. Or question.
I like to say I really appreciate Jenny's sharing what she felt about or what she saw in the Washington.
The debris, yeah.
You just don't get to look in there. What bothers me is we're cleaning up 3 Mile Island, cleaning this and cleaning that, and I don't understand how you clean up something like that. It's there, and just moving it. I don't understand the concept of government doing, and I don't understand why we're not taking a look at simplifying our lifestyle from transporting food long distances. That can be grown in the whole area, and, you know, getting in touch with the problems out there. There's because that's a whole subject of its own. But
I don't get to keep up with this, and I really wish that I could, because I really have enjoyed, you know, sort of dialoguing with you about this. But I thought it was very appropriate that I could be with you while you talked about the Via Negativa. And so there's just one last thing that I wanted to share with you that has been affected me a great deal. And one day I was listening to Mother Teresa, and she was making a presentation, and someone asked her, why does God make our lives so comfortable, and the lives of the people in India that you work with so awful? You know, why? And her answer just knocked me over, and I don't know that I'll ever really understand what she said, but it's really the Via Negativa. She said that she felt that we weren't worthy of suffering the way that the people that she worked with, those who live on the streets, that she really felt that we were not worthy of that. I couldn't believe what she said.
At times I wonder if God has given us up.
We'd never be much closer to what she's saying.